All right, we're back on WIMS 1420 AM, your talk of the South Shore. This is Veterans Unplugged. I am your host, Vince Emanuele. We are streaming live worldwide at WIMSradio.com. That's WIMSradio.com. And I am joined right now. Actually, let me give him a brief introduction. This is from the back of his book, Endgame. Derek Jensen is the acclaimed author of A Language Older Than Words and The Culture of Make-Believe, among many others. Author, teacher, activist, small farmer, and leading voice of uncompromising dissent, he regularly stirs auditoriums across the country with revolutionary spirit. Jensen holds a degree in creative writing from Eastern Washington University, a degree in mineral engineering physics from the Colorado School of Mines, and has taught at Eastern Washington University and Pelican Bay State Prison. Derek, are you there?
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Oh, well, thank you. I'd like to say thanks again for joining us this evening. To be honest with you, it's an absolute honor to have you on the program, and indeed, you know, on a personal level, it is a privilege to interview someone whose work I have admired and learned from for some time. So in short, I want to thank you for your valuable time.
Well, gosh, and I thank you for that, and I want to thank you for yours too, and thank you for your work. It's very important.
Thank you. So now I guess
and
I should.
Before we go on, there's one little technical thing. I'm having a little bit of hard time hearing you. Is there any way you can boost the sound on your end a little bit?
Can you hear me a little better now?
Better now.
Okay, great. I should say on a side note, I found it interesting that once we locked on the interview, those I had told had about one of three responses. So one, they were extremely excited that you were coming on and couldn't wait to tune in. Two, they had no idea who you were or what you were doing or what was going to be discussed. Or three, they absolutely disliked your work and usually responded, quote, yes, that makes sense. You would have Derek Jensen on your show. So, but we could talk about this later in the interview if we have time. But first, let us consider your background and personal history. Where did you grow up? How did these experiences influence your worldview and lead you to the work you're doing today? A lot of times with our guests, I like to put a personal face on these issues, because in my own experiences, personal experiences in my life have led to where I am today. It wasn't necessarily a radical book or a lecture that turned me on to politics and to social movements and so on. So if you can maybe touch a little bit about on your personal history, your background, how these influenced your worldview.
Oh, sure. And how long do we have before the first break so I can tell you make sure to make the story the right length?
Absolutely. We have, I believe, let me check my clock, we have exactly 10 minutes until the next break.
Okay, so I'll give you a 5 or 6 minute version then.
Cool.
So I grew up in Colorado, and I grew up near Boulder, so it was a fairly liberal community. My family was Seventh-day Adventist, so I grew up fundamentalist Christian. In terms of how this has influenced, how my childhood influenced my work, one of the ways was that I remember when I was in about second grade, between first and second grade, they put in a subdivision right near where I live. We lived in the country. And they put in a subdivision right next to it, and it destroyed all sorts of, meadowlark habitat and garter snake habitat and grasshopper habitat. I wouldn't call it habitat at the time. I would have called it homes. And cottonwood and salamander and crawdad. And I recognized, even when I was a kid, that, once again, I couldn't have used this language, but I recognized that you couldn't have infinite growth on a finite planet. I recognized that if you keep building, and I would have said this when I was in second grade, if you keep building, eventually you're going to run out of space. And so I knew that the whole system is insane at that level when I was a kid. And then another thing that influenced me quite a lot was that my father's extremely abusive, and he broke my sister's arm. My brother has epilepsy from the blows of the head. He raped my mother, my sister, and me. And I realized, even when I was a kid, I couldn't articulate this, but I was thinking, if his behavior isn't making him happy, why is he doing it? And in some ways, that's a question that lasts to this day. I mean, if the destruction of the natural world isn't making us happy, why are we doing it? I mean, this is crazy. So in some ways, that helped spark a lifelong interest in understanding this sort of other and self-destructive behavior. And, you know, why child abuse? Whom does that help? How does it Whom does it serve? Whom does it hurt? And so there's another level. And then another thing that happened is, so I'm going along sort of, this is sort of my political awakening of in different areas, but I'm going along in about eighth grade, and up until then, remember I was a Seventh-day Adventist, so we didn't listen to rock music. And then I started to, you know, slide a little bit and started listening to some rock and roll. And a song that's very important to me was Taking Care of Business by Bachman Turner Overdrive.
Mm-hmm.
You get up every morning from your alarm clock's warning, take the 8:15 to the city, and there's a whistle up above and people pushing, people shoving, all the girls trying to look pretty. Well, if your train's on time, you can get to work by 9, start your slaving job and get your pay. Well, if you ever get annoyed, look at me, I'm self-employed. I love to work at nothing all day. It's like, don't ever tell me that art can't change people, because up until that point, I was a good little capitalist. And I heard that song, and something started to trigger inside my head that was like, you know, once again, it took years for this to develop, but I started questioning the wage economy. And when I got to college, I went to school in engineering at the Colorado School of Mines, because I didn't really like it, but I got a scholarship, and it's like, I didn't have the money to go to school, so what are you going to do? You know, it's either go in engineering, or don't know what I'm going to do. So I went in engineering, and I didn't really like it. Most of my fellow students didn't really like it either. And I got this habit at the time, or hobby or something, of asking people if they like their jobs. But 90% would say no. And I started thinking, and by now I'm able to articulate this, I started thinking, what does it mean when the vast majority of people spend the vast majority of their waking hours doing things that they don't want to do? That's crazy. I mean, why have a system where the majority of people are not actually enjoying their lives? And I realized I didn't want to spend my life doing a job I didn't want to do. So what am I going to do? How are you going to survive in a wage economy? Plus, at the time, I really wanted to be a writer. I mean, so that all mixed in. And so what this has to do with everything else is that it's like a friend of mine, an environmental activist friend of mine, says that a lot of environmental activists begin by wanting to protect a specific piece of ground, and they end up questioning the foundations of Western civilization. Because once they ask, why is this land being destroyed, then they start asking, why is land destroyed in general? Why do you have an economic system that's based on extraction? Because there have been other ways of living. I live on Talawa land, and the Talawa Indians lived here 12,500 years at least. And they did it without destroying a place. So it's not because they were too stupid to invent backhoes, it's because they lived entirely differently. So what is it about this extractive way of life? So if you start asking those questions, you know, and you keep asking the questions, you're going to end up questioning the foundations of this whole way of living. And it's the same with questioning the wage economy. If you start asking, why do people work jobs they don't like? Well, then you start asking, why is there a wage economy? And then you start asking, why is there capitalism? And then you start asking, who is served by capitalism? And then you start asking, where did capitalism come from? And why are there these economic power structures where the rich control food, and the rich control the land, and you have to pay somebody in order to survive? How did that develop? And so that's another way it started. And then let's fast forward to my sort of late 20s, and I knew that everything was messed up. I knew that this culture is just crazy, but I wasn't an activist yet. I didn't know what to do. And then I met this friend of mine, John Osborne, who was the heart and soul of the Spokane, Washington environmental community. And he really helped to channel my energy, because I had all this energy. I didn't know what to do with it. You know, what are you going to do? And he helped to focus it. He helped me become an activist. And then one more thing I want to say, and then I'll shut up, is that the smartest thing I ever did, this is in my mid-20s, the smartest thing I ever did was I realized, you know, all the problems we face are just so immense. But where do you start? And I wasn't doing anything. And then it's like, okay, how can I start? And I asked myself, okay, I think I'm not paying enough for gas, because gas is really environmentally destructive. So what I'm going to do is, for every dollar I spend on gas, I'm going to give a dollar to a local environmental group. Local, because they really need money, not national, because they're pretty nasty. So a local environmental group, and so at the time it cost about $10 to fill your tank. And so every time I'd fill my tank, which was maybe once a week at that point, I would give $10 to an environmental organization. But the thing is, I didn't have any money. And so I would pay myself $5 an hour to do activism. I started by writing letters to the editor. It's like, okay, I filled my tank with gas. I got to do 2 hours this week. did letters to the editor. I did anti-fur demos, anti-circus demos. Then from there I moved on to filing timber sale appeals. I just started, because you know, you got to start somewhere. And I didn't know anything except that circuses are bad, for example. And I would just show up, and then somebody would hand me a sign. And I'd, you know, circuses are bad. Circuses are, and when people walk by, they'd say, why are circuses bad? It's like, I don't know. Ask the guy next to me. I just think they're bad. I mean, the point is I didn't let my ignorance stop me.
Right.
I got educated. Or I did a, I don't know, as an ex-military person, I don't know if you know about Fairchild Air Force Base. It's outside of Spokane. And there were some protests out there. And, you know, I'd stand there holding a sign saying, no bombs, you know, or something like that. And people would drive by and they'd honk. And, you know, it's absolutely useless in many ways. But it got me started. And that's how I started being an activist. It's like, do something. You know, later on, I don't know if we'll talk about militant resistance or not. But I always want to say that the big difference is not between those who resist militantly and those who don't. The big difference is between those who do something and those who do nothing. And so I always encourage people, just get started, you know, and then your momentum will build as you do it. And it's really fun, you know. Activism is great. I mean, do you like activism?
I love it. I mean, and I often, you know, one of the best quotes I heard from the late Howard Zinn was, you know, someone asked him, if you had your life to do it over again, would you do it the same way? And he said, in the 60 years of his activist work, he has yet to find something more important, more satisfying to engage in. And in the 5 years that I've been doing this work since I was discharged from the Marine Corps and home from Iraq, I would absolutely agree. You know, I mean, there has to be time for relaxation, so on and so forth. But I will say, you know, when my friends say, well, we're going to a Cubs game this weekend, what are you doing? And I'm saying, well, I'm going to get packed into a room with 30 other activists and we're going to try and hash out how to end these wars. Yeah, I walk away from that experience much more satisfied than I do attending a Cubs game.
Yeah, especially the Cubs are playing this year.
Right. with that being said, we have about 40 seconds left for till we cut to the next break. So I just want to say when we come back, we're on the phone with Derek Jensen, world-renowned author and activist. We're going to be discussing that level of dialogue and critique of Western civilization. So in other words, instead of just simply talking about class warfare, foreign policy, we're taking it to that next level. And in Derek's work, he has done so by simply questioning civilization as a whole, whether or not it's sustainable, how to confront this issue. When we come back, you're listening to WIMS 1420. This is Veterans Unplugged. I'm your host, Vince Emanuele. We're streaming live at WIMSradio.com. Please stay in tune. We're on the phone with Derek Jensen. All right, we're back. Veterans Unplugged. I'm your host, Vince Emanuele, WIMS Radio, 1420 AM, your talk of the South Shore, streaming live at WIMSradio.com. That's streaming live at WIMSradio.com. We are joined on the phone by world-renowned author and political activist, Mr. Derek Jensen. Okay, Derek, when we go into this next question, you know, I discuss a lot of topics on this show. Labor issues, feminist issues, race relations, foreign policy, class warfare. And these conversations take place with everyone from, I would say, Democrats, activists, Marxists, anarchists, so on and so forth, people who don't even self-identify as anything. I guess people such as myself. However, proclaiming that, quote, civilization itself is simply unsustainable, should be confronted and eventually dismantled, I think really takes this critical dialogue to another level. So my question to you is twofold. So simply stated, how and why is civilization unsustainable? And second, if we come to this conclusion, how do we convey such a message without rendering your audience with a sense of helplessness, apathy, or nihilism?
Well, those are great questions. And let's start with the notion of civilization being unsustainable. And a couple things. You actually have been to Iraq. And so when you think of Iraq, when you think of the landscape there, is the first thing that you think of cedar forest so thick that sunlight never touches the ground?
No.
Really?
Yeah.
The first written myth of this culture, or one of the first written myths, is Gilgamesh deforesting the plains and hillsides of Iraq, which were cedar forests so thick that sunlight never touched the ground.
Okay.
And the Arabian Peninsula was oak savanna, and
wow,
the Near East was heavily forested. Greece was heavily forested. All the big three, Plato, Socrates and Aristotle all complained that deforestation was harming water quality. North Africa was heavily forested. North Africa was the breadbasket of Rome. The forests of North Africa were cut down to make the Phoenician and Egyptian navies. There were hippos in the Thames River, and there were lions in what's now the UK also. And the point of me bringing all this up is that this culture has been, let's move this to the Americas for a second. There were passenger pigeons in flocks so large they darkened the sky for days at a time. So you're near Indiana / Illinois, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so there were passenger pigeons in flocks that were that large. And there were whales in the Atlantic. They were so thick that they were a impediment to shipping.
Wow.
And there were shoals of fish that were so large they would actually slow down ships because the ships would be going through the fish. And when you have an extractive economy, it's not sustainable. If you have, say, if we quantify this, if the world is at a scale of 100, well, let's back up, and we'll go out in a different direction. That it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that any way of life that's based on the use of non-renewable resources won't last. Can we agree with that? I mean, is that basically pretty straightforward?
Yeah, I think so.
If your way of living is based on a non-renewable resource or many non-renewable resources, they're eventually going to run out. If you have 100 units of them and you use up 5 units a year, in 20 years they're going to be gone. So you would think that if you have an entire way of life that's based on the use of, let's say, oil, you would think you'd ask yourself what you're going to do when the oil runs out. And we can say the same thing not just about oil but about other minerals. I'm going to take it a step further, and I'm going to say that any way of life that is based on the hyper-exploitation of renewable resources won't last. So if every year there are fewer salmon return than there were the year before, eventually there won't be any. There were salmon runs so thick up here, and I live in the Pacific Northwest, there were salmon runs so thick that one of the things a lot of the Indians would do, just for fun, is they would throw a pebble in the water, and they would see how long it would take for the pebble to actually hit the bottom of the water because the fish are so thick. And it would take minutes. There was one run of salmon up in Alaska in the 1930s that was 12 miles wide and 28 days long. And I've seen pictures of some runs of salmon. Nowadays, I live in salmon country, and I'm lucky if I see 3 or 4 fish. But there were runs of salmon that are so thick that you cannot. This is a whole river. And it looks like the bottom of the river is dark gray until you see just a few splotches of sand below, and you realize the river is literally full of fish. This is how things were. And so if every year there are fewer salmon return than the year before, eventually there won't be any. I mean, the Great Lakes were similarly just ridiculously full of fish. And I just read an article the other day about some fisherman from one of the Great Lakes, I don't remember, has now taken his boat all the way up to Alaska because he can't make a living anymore. You know, the Great Lakes have just been hammered. And everywhere has been hammered. And so when that's happening, and migratory songbird populations, a study done a couple years ago, that migratory songbird populations along the east coast of the U.S. have collapsed by about, many types have collapsed by about 70 to 80% in the last 40 years. Now that's terrible. That freaked me out until I realized that 40 years ago is after Silent Spring. So they've gone down 70% from having already gone down 70%. And you know, we can talk about this with bison, we can talk about it with prairie dogs, we can talk about it with whatever. So any way of life that's based on the hyper-exploitation of renewable resources won't last. I know we've all been told that survival, you know, evolution is based on survival of the fittest. You know, like basically what that means is survival of meanness, survival of the ones who are able to exploit the best. That's what we're taught. If you ever watch any nature programs, that's what it's all about, is like who can be the king, who can be the one on top. But to show how silly that is, the notion that evolution is based on this pure competition, to see who can exploit the most, I can show that that's not true in one sentence. Just give me a couple of semicolons. And that is, those creatures who survived in the long run have survived in the long run, semicolon. You don't survive in the long run by hyper-exploiting your surroundings, semicolon. You survive in the long run by actually making your habitat better. And that's a really, I mean, it just seems so obvious when you say it, but our inculcation into this culture of competition and this culture of where it's like the whole world is really a game of risk, is so deep that, you know, we have to stop and step back and think about that. Because once again, if you're going to, that's what salmon do, is they make the forest a better place simply by living and dying. And that's what bears do. And that's what the Talawa Indians did who lived here for like I said, 12,500 years at least. And so there's something really wrong with the notion of basing your way of life both on non-renewable resources and on the hyper-exploitation of renewable resources. And I want to say one more thing, and then we'll I guess go to question two, which is I'm going to take this a step further. And I'm going to say that any way of life that's based on the use of resources won't last. And what I mean by that is that resources don't actually exist. And what I mean by that is that trees don't consider themselves a timber resource, and salmon don't consider themselves a fisheries resource. They're just trees and they're just fish. And this is really important because so many indigenous people have said to me that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even the most open-minded Westerners generally perceive listening to the natural world as a metaphor, as opposed to the way the world really works. In other words, Westerners generally perceive the world as consisting of resources to be exploited, as opposed to other beings to enter into relationship with. And so there's no reason to think that, I mean, I'm sitting outside, and, you know, these trees all have lives that are as valuable to them as mine is to me. And I saw bears earlier today, and the bears have lives as valuable to them as mine is to me. And this is really crucial because there's this great line by a Canadian lumberman, when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. And if when you look at trees, you see trees, you'll treat them another way. And if when you look at this particular tree, you see this particular tree, you treat it differently still. Same is true for fish. If when I look at salmon, I see dollar bills, I'm going to treat them one way. If I look at salmon, I see salmon, I'll treat them another way. And same is true for women. If when I look at women, I see orifices, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at women, I see women, I'll treat them another way. If when I look at this particular woman, I see this particular woman, I'll treat her differently still. And having said all this, I also want to say that just because when I see this particular fish, I see this particular fish, doesn't mean that I can't eat it. And just because I see this particular tree doesn't mean I can never cut down a tree. I was doing a radio interview several years ago in Spokane, Washington, and the interviewer said, you know, Indians exploited the salmon too. And I said, no, they didn't. They ate them. And he said, well, what's the difference? I said, well, they gave him respect for the spirit in exchange for the flesh. I knew my answer was kind of nonsense, but, you know, I'm a male, and so I'm required by law to answer every question that's asked of me. But then that afternoon, I went out, I sat next to the tree, I had a long relationship with, and I asked the tree, what's the fundamental predator-prey relationship? And the tree gave me the answer right away, which is, if you consume the flesh of another, you now take responsibility for the continuation of the other community. Hmm. What this means is, if I eat salmon from the Klamath River, I now take responsibility, and responsibility comes from the root, respondere, to give and return. I now take responsibility for the continuation of the salmon, the Klamath River salmon community. And everybody knows this. I mean, bears know that if they eat, or mergansers know that if they eat all the newts in a pond, they're not going to be able to eat newts anymore. And so they don't. I mean, that's how you survive. You don't survive if you destroy your land base. I mean, it's embarrassing to even have to say this.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's one of the things. And I'm going to make a little transition now to your second question, which is, you know, what do all of the so-called solutions to global warming, or whatever problem we face, especially global warming, let's talk about that, what do all the so-called solutions to it have in common? And what they all have in common is they all take industrial capitalism as a given. What they're all attempting to protect is industrial capitalism. You know, Al Gore's solutions, Bill McKibben's solutions, sure. All these people's solutions, they take that as a given. And that's literally insane in terms of being out of touch with physical reality. Because any solution has to take the real world as that which is the independent variable. Because without a real world, you don't have any social system whatsoever. And this is really crucial. Because it's like a doctor friend of mine says, the first step toward cure is proper diagnosis. And I actually find that when I am presented with false solutions to problems, that I end up getting more despairing than if somebody simply tells me the truth. You know, I have Crohn's disease. It's a terrible disease. And honestly, I would rather know that I have Crohn's disease so that I can figure out what to do about it than for people to keep telling me that I don't have Crohn's disease, that the problems I face are not as severe as the problems I face. I would rather know how severe the problems are so that I can deal with them. Does that make sense?
Makes absolute sense. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to add a personal aside here. People always ask me, why aren't more Marines and soldiers opposing the wars? And my
I'm having a really hard time. Can you do whatever you did before to make it so I can hear you better?
Yeah. Can you hear me a little better now?
Okay, thank you. Can you start over?
See, on a personal aside, people always ask me, they say, Vince, like, why aren't there more Marines and soldiers who are protesting the war in the capacity that you and other folks in IVAW, VFP, and some of these other organizations are? And I usually have a pretty simple response. I say, look, if there's one thing that's for certain, when someone comes home from a war, they want to believe that whatever they killed for, whatever they witnessed, this massive atrocities and watched their friends get killed and have to take human life, they want to come home and they want to believe that it was for something. They want to believe that that experience and those experiences meant something in their lives. And the hardest thing in the long term, but the best thing I could ever do, was to come home, look myself in the mirror, go visit friends of mine who were killed, and go visit their parents, and straight up tell them and tell myself and the people who would ask me about this war, no, I killed Iraqis for no good reason, and not only did I kill them for no good reason, I actually killed them for the benefit of a bunch of rich people who are running the world. And that's something, in the same token, like, it's easy to tell myself, oh yeah, I went to the war, and maybe it wasn't right, or this or that, or maybe it was just a mistake, but to take it to that other level is the reality of the situation. And so on that note, like, yes, I would much rather look myself in the mirror and say, hey, look, Vince, this is what you did overseas. This is what you're responsible for. But in the same token, accepting that, what are you willing to do now? You know, instead of constantly fooling myself or telling myself a narrative that allows myself to feel better instead of simply facing reality as it is.
If you don't mind me asking, how old are you?
I'm 27. Just turned 27, actually, in May.
Oh my gosh, you're so much smarter and wiser than I was at 27.
Well, that gives me some hope, that's for sure. Thank you for that. No, I do appreciate that. But that's, I mean, to be honest with you, Derek, that's the reality. I mean, I didn't, you know, folks all the time, they say, hey, you know, why aren't there these folks out there? And I say, hey, look, it's hard. I mean, when you take someone else's life, when you watch your best friends get killed, literally feet from you or inches from you, the easy thing to do is to go home and to tell yourself this, you know, sort of fancy, flowery narrative. But to go home, look yourself in the mirror and say, yes, I took people's lives so oil companies and transnational corporations and banksters can profit, and some of my best friends that I've ever met in my life are now dead. Due to this insatiable urge for profit and power. Yeah, it's an uncomfortable conclusion to come to, but in the long term, as you had stated, by recognizing a disease or other...
Well, that's another thing that I know is the case for me, and I'm going to ask you if it's the case for you, is that maintaining a lie takes a tremendous amount of energy. And I know for myself that simply acknowledging that the problem is the entire culture, and the problem is this culture that's based on empire, that's based on conquest, and that's based on the lives of the poor going to serve the rich, acknowledging that the problem is that systemic was actually very liberating for me and very... It released a lot of energy, because one of the things that happened is I stopped identifying with the system itself, and I started to, that freed up tremendous amounts of energy. I was no longer fighting myself when I would fight the system. Does it make sense?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, the other part of what you were talking about that I would like to get into a little bit, and this is the second part of that question, was, you know, how do you convey this message? Because I've also given people your work before, and as I had mentioned, you know, they come back with one of a couple responses. Either they love it, or they come away and they say, oh, you know, now I feel helpless, I feel sort of apathetic, and I go, well, wait a minute, like, did you not read everything that was in the book? Or did you not read, or did you not pay attention to the lecture, so on and so forth? But I become frustrated, I guess, talking about this issue in particular, by, you know, almost rendering, like, the audience with a sense of helplessness, apathy, nihilism. Like, how do you convey this message without doing that? I think that's, I mean, to me, that's really interesting.
Well, a few things. One of them is that, something that really helped me is something I read maybe 20 years ago where some guy, I don't remember who, some author, was saying, Robert Coombs, I think his name was saying that it takes 10 years to change your mind. And that is really sort of true in my own experience, that I don't normally have an epiphany and then change my entire life the next day. It takes a long time, and so a lot of times if I present my perspective to someone and they respond with some hostility, I don't pursue it because the time isn't right. There are plenty of people out there. I get a lot of notes every day from people saying, thank you so much, I thought I was crazy, but now I know the culture's crazy. And I still remember when I was 27 and I was in a library and this book jumped off the bookshelf at me. It was Neil Everton's The Natural Alien. And it was the first book I ever read that did not take the utilitarian perspective as a given, by which I mean that things are valued by how much monetary value they have. And he said this in terms of, what do you do when you make some impassioned defense of some creature? And at the end, the other person says to you, well, that's fine that you really care about the snail darter, but what good is it? He says, really, the only response is to say, well, what good are you? And not to insult them, but to point out the absurdity of that question. I mean, if your value, your monetary value is probably, you know, what, your blood's worth $100 and your bones are worth $20 as fertilizer, you know, if you break it down like that, you know, you're worth, what, $500? You know, that's... But that's silly, but that's how people look at non-humans. But that's not how, well, that's frankly how they look at humans, too. I was talking to this guy at Yale. These people had me do a video talk. And at one point, this guy asked me, so what do you think about the whole notion of putting a value on everything in nature, and that will help people protect it? Because if you know the tree is worth X amount of dollars, then you don't cut it down. You know, you get more than that. You know, you value its worth taking CO2 out of the atmosphere. And I said, okay, let's think about this for a second. So how much are you worth in terms of value? Because, you know, like at Bhopal, when there were a lot with any of these catastrophes, the corporations always value people based on their wages.
Sure.
And so I said, how much are you worth? And he said, well, actually, and the guy was an economics major, the UN has developed figures for that, and me, going to Yale, my net value is going to be about $4.5 million for my earnings for my life or whatever.
Wow.
I said, okay, great. Wonderful. Right now, let's say the government comes to your family and they says, hey, we're going to give you $5 million and we're going to kill your kids. How's that for a deal? You're going to make $500,000 on it. Isn't that a great deal? And he didn't like it.
Yeah.
And the point is that, of course, no living being wants to be valued for the money. Oh, but the real point is that I read this book that was saying all these things, and like this huge weight went off my shoulders, because my whole life I've been reading all these books that took this as a given. I didn't know that there was this whole literature that didn't take the utilitarian worldview as a given. And I suddenly felt free. Oh my gosh, I'm not crazy. It's the culture that's crazy. And that's happened with so many things. So one of the things is that I recognize that people aren't going to change overnight, you know? And another part that's really important is we need to recognize that the despair is an absolutely necessary part of the process. People fight despair so hard. They seem to have this idea that if you recognize how bad things are, that it'll kill you. Well, I'm a complex enough being that I can hold in my heart the understanding. I'll back up a little bit. there's this, years and years and years ago, probably 18, 19 years ago, there's this friend of mine. I was really, probably, I'd been an actor for maybe 4 or 5 years at that point. And I was going through this complete collapse. Things are so terrible, you know, and it's just getting worse. And we're trying to protect land, but, you know, there's the classic line by David Brower that every victory is temporary and every loss is permanent. A lot of my environmentalist friends are saying, you know, just take some time off, Derek. You know, the problem's going to be there when you come back. You know, it's just, you're getting burned out. So I'm not getting burned out. I'm just sad. And then one day I called this friend of mine, the Okanagan writer and activist, Jeanette Armstrong, and I was just sobbing. And I said, you know, this work is just killing me. It's breaking my heart. She said, yeah, it'll do that. And I said, you know, the dominant culture just hates everything, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does. And I said, it has a death urge, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does. I said, unless it stops, it's going to kill everything on the planet, isn't it? She said, yeah, it is, unless it stops. I said, we're not going to make it some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And she stopped for a moment, and then she said the best thing she could possibly say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And that was the best thing she could say, because it normalized my despair. It let me know that despair is an appropriate response to a desperate situation. It let me know that the sorrow is just sorrow, and the pain is just pain. And it's not so much the sorrow or even the pain that hurts as it is my resistance to it. It let me know that I could feel all those things and it wouldn't kill me. You know, it's like, we have this idea that if you acknowledge that, yeah, the United States is an imperialist power, the United States bombs, you know, people all over the planet, the United States is based, I mean, any empire is based on conquest. If you acknowledge that, then you're supposed to go around feeling miserable all the time. But the truth is, I'm really happy, you know? And I'm full of rage and sorrow and hate and joy and love and contentment and discontent. And the other thing that happens is that if you feel all those things, it does kill you. And there's a wonderful thing about being dead, which is that once you're dead, they can't touch you anymore. You can still sing and you can still dance and you can still make love and you can still fight, but they can't touch you. There's this great poem by the Zen poet Bunan. Die when you're alive and be absolutely dead, then do whatever you want, it's all good. And one of the things that says to me is that one of the parts of the process that is so necessary is that we need to, okay, I want to be really clear. You know, I was raised a Seventh-day Adventist, but I've not been a Christian for 30 years now. That said, the story of Jesus is a wonderful metaphor. Let's just forget the whole divinity thing for a second. But the whole notion of death and rebirth is so important. It's like the central metaphor. And one of the things that we have to do, I think, is we have to die and be reborn, not in not in any sort of Christian sense at all, not in a born-again Christian sense, but instead in what has to die is your identification with the system. The patriarchal man within me has to die so that I can be a real man who is not patriarchal but is pro-feminist. And the person who is raised, the white male who is raised as a capital W white within this white supremacist culture, that has to die so that I can then become an ally to people of color. And it's not, I mean, I'm making it seem more dramatic than it is.
No. I mean, I don't want to cut you off there, but see, now what you're saying there, I identify with that, because at some point when I started to analyze the world, I started to read about things, I'm going, what is really important here? Like, what makes people tick? And one of those things, at least the conclusion that I had come to, was identity. Like, how do you identify? You know, I saw so many people in the Marine Corps identify as Marines, tough white males from America, and they were going to kill these brown people, and they were going to drink Budweiser, and they were going to go to football games. And then I came home and I'd run into people who, you know, they'd say, yeah, I identify as an American. I identify as an Italian American, like some members of my family. And I, you know, all these identity issues. And I'd take a step back and I'd go, wait a minute. Like, what are we really? I mean, at the very base level, I simply identify as a human being and as a member of this planet. I mean, as an animal, I'm here. And outside of that identification or self-identification, it's, to me, you know, very important, I guess, to break away or to shed those identities, as you are explaining here, was like just my ability to come to the conclusion that, okay, if I can get it down to the very basic level, I'm a human being, I'm on this rock that's floating in the middle of nowhere, and I've got to figure out a way to survive in a decent way.
Yep.
And so at the very base level, that's at least where I've come to. I mean, right now, I'm at 27. Like, that's...
Well, see, and that's one of the reasons I'm saying you're so much smarter and wiser than I was, because I didn't do that till my mid-30s.
Okay.
So you're way ahead of where I was.
Well, let's talk... Let's get a little bit into resistance.
Wait,
there.
One more thing, too.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's great. Which is that this identification, you know, it can be really... It's really painful, and that's part of the despair. And then another thing I want to say about... And it's liberating, eventually. But another thing I want to say about that is that it can happen on so many levels. And one of the levels that is pretty superficial that annoys some of my friends is just not identifying with those in power, not saying we, like we invaded Iraq.
Yep.
And that's even true, I believe, would be true for you, because you don't identify with that system anymore. And so people will say to me, how much longer do you think we're going to be in Iraq? And I'm like, we? I thought we're in Northern California. You know, I'm not the U.S. government.
Yep.
And how much longer do you think our troops are going to be in Iraq? It's like, I got troops.
Right.
I didn't know I had troops.
If only, right?
And so, I wish I had troops.
Right.
And so I think that, even on that level, like my mom, it annoys my mom. I've been doing this for years and it still bugs her. Probably, you know. Anyway, that she'll say, we were watching some analysis of the interview with Cheney, and she was going on and on about, oh, it's just so terrible that we torture. And I said, Mom, you torture? We torture? I didn't know we torture. And she's like, I'm too old for this. You know, don't give me this lecture again.
Right.
But yeah, it's even on that level to say, you know, I don't torture because I don't identify with them.
Right. And if we were put in the capacity to make those decisions, chances are the majority of the citizens, at least that I know, and as screwed up as America is, simply wouldn't choose to torture people.
Well, that's a really interesting point too. I know you want to get to resistance, but that's a really interesting point too. I was thinking about this yesterday because Evo Morales had all this pro-indigenous rhetoric, but now
you know
power.
What. Damn, sorry, I was gonna pull up, you know, I didn't have enough time because we were pushed up against, the time block for your interview, but I just yanked an article off of AlJazeera.net called Indigenous Activists Gain Momentum in Bolivia. But go ahead, because I was gonna touch on that article. I'll touch on it next week.
Well, he's going full speed ahead for all sorts of oil and gas projects.
Highways.
Very unpopular for obvious reasons among indigenous people. And, you know, Obama has made many, many, many terrible decisions and continues to make many, many terrible decisions. And I mean, I have no problem saying that Cheney, I mean, he just seems like a really nasty guy. And Obama may very well be nice personally. I have no idea. But years ago, I interviewed this guy, David Edwards, and one of the things he said that really helped me to understand some things is that, you know, individuals are, for the most part, constrained. This doesn't excuse them.
Sure.
But a few years ago, I think in 2000 or something, when Nader was running for president, maybe it was even 96, he said, if elected, I won't do anything about health care because I won't be allowed to.
Right.
And the point is that Obama, no matter whether he's a nice person or a nasty person, his job is to be the capitalist in chief.
Yep.
And his job is to serve capital. And it's crazy to think that he will do anything other than to serve the ends of capital. It doesn't matter whether he is, I mean, it's like the good cop, bad cop routine. I've long since realized that that's how the Democrats and Republicans work.
Sure.
That basically the Democrats are the good cop who comes in and promises you a good deal if you just roll over, and then the Republicans are the ones who come in and say they're going to beat you up.
Right.
And the point is that I don't know. I mean, yes, we can say, you and I can say, that if we were in that position, we would not order torture. And I believe that's true. But that doesn't alter the fact that I don't think that you or I would want to run for president. And
no.
People who want to run for president are going to be power-oriented anyway.
Sure.
It attracts a certain set,
yep.
A certain mindset. And then in addition, once you get there, their job is to serve the ends. See, this is one of the things that, and I know this is a whole other topic, but this is one of the things that's just sort of, one of the places I do come together very much with some of the far, far, far right, is that I've long thought that a lot of the people who voted for NAFTA and GATT should have been tried for treason, for actually subverting the sovereignty of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
My point with all this is that it's long been clear to me, you know, for a while I thought that the politicians at least served the ends of the U.S. government, whatever that may be, but actually I don't think they do, especially in this age of transnational corporations. I've long since said that, you know, ExxonMobil long ago had a coup. You know, the United States government is run by the corporation. Everybody knows that. But the loyalty of those in charge is absolutely to the transnationals.
Yeah. No, that's Julian Assange in a recent interview he said the same thing. I mean, someone asked him, how do you think the United States of America as a sovereign nation functions? And he looked at the interview with a pretty sly sort of look and comment, and he just simply stated, the United States of America is a useful tool. I mean, to him, it was like unbelievable that this interviewer would even ask him about the United States sovereignty, because to him, you know, it had been long understood that, yeah, I mean, it's a useful tool. And when transnational bankers and corporate CEOs are done with this tool, they'll simply move on to the next useful nation where they can maximize profits and filter money. I mean, it's like, you know, it's just unbelievable to hear as simply stated like that.
So here's a question I've always wanted to get, and nobody's ever asked me. I've wanted to get this question so that, I've wanted, like, for a Fed in the audience to ask me this question and to entrap me. So here's the question I want you to ask, which is, so are you advocating the overthrow of the U.S. government?
Okay. Are you, Derek Jensen, advocating the overthrow of the U.S. government?
You know, even if I were, it's way too late for that, because it happened a long time ago, done by ExxonMobil, done by Monsanto, done by Cargill and ADM, you know.
Yep.
If I wanted to, I missed my chance.
Yep. No, I think that's a great statement. Let's move into this question about resistance here. So, you know, as I had mentioned, I did 4 years in the Marine Corps. I got out. I joined Iraq Veterans Against the War in an effort to stop the war and really to organize dissent within the military, which I think is the most important function of IVAW. Part of what we've been discussing is to create this culture of resistance. So this is actually a term and a concept we use pretty often in the GI resistance movement, and our aim being obviously to foment resistance at all levels and to encourage folks in the military to think of activism and organizing as simply part of their daily lives and not something to do necessarily for fun on the weekends. You know, in your recent book, which I haven't had a chance to, I'm not even going to lie, I haven't had a chance to blow through all of those pages, Deep Green Resistance with Lear Keith and Eric McBay, you guys discuss the possibilities, strategies, and tactics to use in order to begin this process of building this culture. So can you give me some examples of what you mean when you use the term culture of resistance?
Well, it can mean many different things depending upon the circumstance. And in a couple examples that are pretty straightforward would be in World War II, there was an entire different, resistance was entirely different in Poland than it was in Denmark, because Denmark was a model protectorate and was treated very well. So we've all heard the story of how the, when the Jews were supposed to put on the stars, that the king put on the first star. And that was an appropriate act of resistance in Denmark. And in Poland, for example, or in Russia, if somebody in some sort of power would have put on a star, Nazis would have said, great, you get on a car with them, you know?
Right.
That would not have been appropriate. In Poland or Russia, it would be more appropriate to blow up bridges, blow up troop trains, destroy warehouses, you know, do whatever a more active resistance would be.
Mm-hmm.
We can look through, I mean, the question of what does a culture of resistance look like, once again, it's entirely dependent upon circumstances. You get the ANC in South Africa, which started off above ground, started off nonviolent, and then moved toward underground violent resistance against apartheid. You get the civil rights movement from, you know, going all the way back to the Pullman Porters and before, to slave revolts. But through the Pullman Porter area with the Pullman Porter strike, and then through the Harlem Renaissance and then up through the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s, you have a movement that is dedicated to nonviolence and dedicated to affecting political change. And that one was, once again, almost entirely nonviolent. And the only reason I'm putting in almost is because I don't want, you know, I'm nervous about committing to an absolute here, but let's just say it's nonviolent. And, but see, that's one of the reasons I'm saying almost is because at the same time, in the 60s, you've also got Malcolm X talking about,
sure.
excuse me, Ed, for goodness sake, who am I talking about when I say it was all nonviolent? We have the Black Panthers and the Black Liberation Army.
Sure.
So, I'm sorry to have said that. That was a terrible thing to say, actually. So you have these non-militant forms and these militant forms working together. A culture of resistance, for me, means first and foremost, it's like so many indigenous people have said, that the first and most important thing that any of us have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds, which is exactly what you're talking about before, which is breaking your identity with the system and then identifying with the oppressed. And then it's figuring out, starting to think strategically, what do we want? In the case of the civil rights movement, one of the things they wanted is the right to vote. And the same with the suffragist movement. They want the right to vote. They want to be considered human beings. And so part of it is to think strategically. And then after that is to think, okay, so how are we going to achieve those ends? And so, for example, with the Iraq War Veterans for Peace, what do you want? Actually, what are some of your overarching goals?
Well, our objectives, we have four objectives. They're pretty clear, and they encompass, we can encompass, obviously, veterans who are anarchists all the way to registered Republicans, as long as they, you have to have served since September 11th, for one. And for two, the objectives are immediate withdrawal of all troops from Iraq and Afghanistan, reparations for the Iraqi and Afghani people, and full benefits for returning servicemen and women.
So when I was saying earlier that the thing that a friend of mine said about a lot of environmentalists begin by wanting to protect a specific piece of ground, they end up questioning the foundations of Western civilization, does that same hold true for a lot of the members of your organization in that they begin by questioning the occupation of Iraq, and they end up questioning militarism, and then they end up from there questioning capitalism, and they keep moving toward more foundational? Does that generally happen, or does that not happen a lot?
I think it generally happens. But as you had mentioned before, now this is what's interesting to me, is at different paces. So for example, 5 years ago, all I knew was that we shouldn't be in Iraq, Iraq was bad, and that they lied to us. That's all I knew at the very base level. Now, 5 years later, I'm on the phone having a conversation with you about why we should dismantle civilization as a whole. So,
right.
Like in a short-term 5-year space for me personally, yes, I jumped from Iraq to then looking at the empire, to then looking at extreme capitalism, to then denouncing capitalism as a whole, to then identifying as a Marxist, and then saying, well, you know, I don't really want to identify as anything. And I'll probably get yelled at from my Marxist friends, but that's from hanging out with a bunch of Marxists. And I don't mean to be facetious there. I just mean, I agree. I think that this has been a process, and I think at different paces that this takes place more often than not. So yes, a lot of veterans I know who are in that organization started off because they simply wanted us out of Iraq and Afghanistan. And now we have veterans who are engaged in all sorts of struggles and at different levels as well. So yes, I would say that's my experience. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, talking about resistance, or part of this, I guess I should ask you as well, you know, I remember seeing the footage of BP, the oil spill, on TV at work. Are you there, Derek?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. You know, I remember seeing the BP oil spill footage at work. In order to pay rent, I also work at a bar restaurant. I book music there. It's actually a nice place. It's an interracial bar. Like we should still have to say that in 2011, but
noticing that
it is cool. Like we've got black folks that hang out with white folks. It's about 50-50 at any given point. We get blues music, jazz music, so on and so forth. So it's kind of a cool cultural place for me to have to work and simply, you know, make some money to pay rent. But I was talking to fellow workers when we were watching this on TV, and one particular woman criticized me for not recycling everything at work and, you know, still talking about the environment. And she said, you know, and yet criticizing BP and the oil industry and hence capitalism as a whole. But I simply responded by noting that, you know, I was like, look, those who recycled in the Gulf of Mexico are probably more concerned about the oil industry and capitalism in light of an oil spill that rendered their livelihoods simply obsolete, as opposed to wondering whether or not they threw their beer can in the recycling bin at home that day. And, like, I don't mean to minimize that behavior or to minimize those lifestyle choices, but it's...
There's a great line by Lear Keith that really sums this up for me, which is, the task of an activist is not to navigate systems of oppressive authority with as much integrity as possible. The task of an activist is to take down those systems of oppressive authority. I'll say this again. The task of an activist is not to navigate systems of oppressive authority with as much integrity as possible. The task of an activist is to take down those systems of oppressive authority. And think about this. I mean, think about the Vietnamese fighting against the U.S. military. Does it really matter whether they used U.S.-made weapons or not? Or members of resistance in the Russian resistance in World War II? Does it really matter if they used captured weapons? I mean, do they need to be pure about this?
Right.
So purity, and here's another way to put all this, is the people who come after are not really going to care how pure we live. What they're going to care about is results.
Yep.
What they're going to care about is whether they can drink the air or drink the water and breathe the air.
Yep.
And I think the same is true for the people of Iraq. They're not really, I don't think that they particularly care about your personal purity. What I think they care about more, I'm guessing, would be whether there is an occupying army there.
Yes. Absolutely.
So really what I'm interested in is results. And I mean, and I say this as somebody who, I mean, it's pretty funny because in many ways I live pretty cheaply, but that's mainly because I'm a cheapskate, you know? It's not a political act.
Right.
You know, I don't throw away clothes until they're like rags falling off my back, but that's, I think, more obsessive compulsive than it is environmental, you know?
Right.
So yeah, the whole purity thing doesn't really... And it's crazy how much that has taken over the, especially environmental movement.
That's for sure.
Does anybody in their right mind think that recycling would have stopped Hitler?
Right.
Or that, riding a bicycle would have stopped apartheid? I mean, it's just crazy. It's like, yeah, we're gonna really show Hitler, we're gonna ride our bikes to work. It's like, that does nothing to address the issues of power. And I mean, if somebody wants to ride a bike to work, that's great. I don't have a problem with it, but, we shouldn't delude ourselves into believing. I mean, do you think that the United States military really cares whether you, whether you use less oil so that drives the price down for Iraqi oil by an infinitesimal amount? I don't think they particularly care what you do personally on that level. And here's another thing about all that, is after Bhopal, one of the first things that Union Carbide did was they spun off all of their consumer goods divisions so that they would not be liable to or susceptible to a boycott. You see what I'm saying?
Yep.
They
yep.
didn't want for people to be able to boycott them, so they immediately, you know, within a year or something, spun off all those corporations, all the consumer goods parts. And so they could still continue because all they were doing is selling their goods to... You know, they were selling Union Carbide goods to, I don't know, I'm making up the company. They're selling them to Monsanto or selling them to some other corporation.
Right.
And so there was absolutely no way that individual choices could make any difference whatsoever. Not only was the difference trivial in those cases, it was, and here this takes us back to cultural resistance. Because part of the problem with all of these personal purity acts is that they're not organized. I'm not saying anything against boycotts. The question is, Rosa Parks all by herself would have accomplished nothing.
Right.
But Rosa Parks, as part of an organized campaign, was able to bring the bus companies to their knees.
Right.
And that's the thing, is I don't have a problem with this personal purity, but they have this absolute, they put that in opposition to actual organized resistance. Mm-hmm. And that's the point. Remember early on I said that the question is not really whether you're militant or non-militant. The question is whether you do something or whether you don't do something.
Sure.
That's really what it comes down to here. I don't really, I mean, it doesn't matter to me whether somebody is going to try to stop racism in this country by taking the approach of the Black Panthers or the BLA or Martin Luther King. That's not the important question to me. The important question to me, or I don't want to just use Martin Luther King as a figurehead. I mean, there's also the entire civil rights movement.
Right.
You know, the freedom riders. But the question is whether people are doing something to resist that racism and to, and doing it in terms of, especially in terms of organized political resistance.
And you know, touching on individual choices. I know I had shared this with you in an email, and I'm going to mention it again here, and I mention it pretty often when I talk to folks. You know, when we were in Iraq, the neighborhoods that we didn't go into were the neighborhoods that ambushed us every single time we came into their neighborhood. So towns like Husayba, towns like Al-Qaim, when we went into those neighborhoods, they would ambush us. Hence, we wouldn't go back to those neighborhoods. Now, if those people in those neighborhoods with the sort of, what to use your terminology, death urge that we really did have as Marines who were trained to kill people, if we would have went into those neighborhoods and those folks would have been occupying cafes, marching in the streets, sitting on the ground, I'm going to be quite honest with you. Back in 2004, 2005, the unit I was in would have simply opened fire, beat, or tortured those folks and continued with our mission. And I can say that unequivocally. I mean, I know that for sure because we did it, one, and two, that was the reality of where we were. You know, and so when I got home, I became frustrated as an activist and as a community organizer because just having these discussions with folks on the left, I would automatically be labeled as this radical, whacked out vet who saw too much combat, and now he just wants to lash out and he thinks that nonviolent resistance is not efficient. And, you know, in the same way that you had mentioned it, I mean, let's talk about this in a nuanced fashion. I'm not saying there's one sort of resistance. I mean, I would go really with what you're saying, which is the more important thing is to engage and organize at a very base level as opposed to simply, you know, whether it's this resistance or that resistance. But it became very frustrating. So, you know, and it, one of the premises you use in your in Endgame is that violence done by those lower on the hierarchy to those higher is unthinkable. So when we talk about these forms of resistance or different tactics and strategies, you know, folks who are proposing any sort of an alternative vision are almost marginalized immediately, at least in my experience.
I think that's really true. And it, this, yeah, the one you're talking about is...
Oh, and just to tell you, Derek, I'm sorry, but we have 3 minutes. I'm sorry to cut you like that, but I just want to let you know. What'd you say?
I said we should do it again.
Oh, you know what? I would absolutely love to do it again. I'm only about halfway through the questions I had typed out, but...
Okay, well, yeah, let's do it again. It's been fun. Your questions are great.
Well, thank you. Derek Jensen, again, I'm going to have to read this so folks know who you are. Derek Jensen, acclaimed author of Language Older Than Words, Culture of Make-Believe, and the books I have in front of me, Endgame, Volumes 1 and 2, Dreams, Deep Green Resistance, and Resistance Against Empire. You interview a couple of my favorite folks in there, too. Thanks for your time. Seriously, on a personal level, I enjoyed this, and I'm sure our listeners got a lot out of this. The folks who were excited to hear you, let me tell you, we're really excited to hear you.
Okay.
So thanks a lot for this, Derek. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
All right, take care.
Have a great day.